report on the trip that I was able to make because you sent me. And I want to start by thanking you for the many ways that you've not only given me opportunity, not only to represent you, but to preach the gospel and to, and I couldn't count the number of places and the number of opportunities that have been given to me because of your support and your allowing me the freedom to do this. We'll just start here. I want us to, well, it said it was on. Is it on? I turned it on. Now is it on? No. This is why I hate this stuff. Ah, now we're going. Now we're in business. I see something happening. Nothing is happening. It buzzed. It moved. The little deal is beeping. And you're going to help me, Wayne. Thank you.
I don't know if I can help you, Paul.
See what you can do there. Am I turning it the wrong direction? Maybe I'm close. I'm sorry. That's the laser.
He's going to need that back there.
What?
He needs this part back here.
He needs that part back there. So it's not my fault. Isn't that nice? All right, let's see what we can do when he plugs that in. Buzzing. What? All right. I'm going to do a little talking while they get this working. Okay. Well, let me tell you about the deal in Cuba. All of us have grown up with Cuba on our mind. We thought a lot about it, mainly because it was, for many years, a communist country, still is. And Fidel Castro was there for those times. You remember anxiously watching your television when they were deciding what to do with the missiles down there and everything. And it's also, unlike many other communist countries, it's really close to us, and so it was hard not to take it all real personal. And so we've had a very awkward relationship with this country. What happens during those kinds of things is that the church is affected by it, both the church here and the church there. Back in the 1890s, there was a mission work that actually began in Cuba, and this mission work was, 1870s, mission work was begun there by the Churches of Christ, but you might remember, knowing Restoration history, that the Church of Christ was going through its own difficulties towards the end of the 1800s, and that was when we were dividing over instrumental music and over missionary societies, and the congregations that were established in Cuba were mostly from congregations that they still called themselves Churches of Christ, but they were more like we would think of as Disciples of Christ. They were around until the 1920s, and they finally left there. They had started several churches, and most of the buildings they donated to the Presbyterian churches, and most of the missionaries came home, and most of the members went into other denominational churches. In the 1930s, a new group started, and it was started by a guy named Jose Ricardo, and he baptized a young man who was training to be a Methodist missionary to Cuba. It was a Cuban man, and his name was Ernestino Estevez. And after these two men got together, they started working on evangelizing and going into the work there. A church in Tampa, Florida sent them, and they began really the founding of these congregations. One of their early preachers was a man they baptized who couldn't read or write, but he was so excited about the gospel, he said, "You have to teach me to read and write so I can study and I can preach." And they used the Bible as this textbook, and they taught him Bible at the same time they taught him to read and write. Throughout the rest of his life, he still claimed to be the ignorant preacher, but he was also a carpenter, and he built 6 church buildings all over, scattered around across that country. And he would go into places where there was no preacher and where nobody else could read and write either, and he started preaching, and he would build the buildings. The buildings he built were wooden, and in tropical country, that they don't last very long, and they've all gone to ruin. Now you see the interesting thing about Cuba, as far as where we were, we landed in Havana, which is right in here, and then the convention or the preacher's meeting was up here on this island. Now the reason for that is the Cuban government has been very interested in having conventions and tourists, and tourists have been going there for several years from Canada and from Switzerland and from France and stuff like that. And so they, even though they're communists, they made a capitalistic deal with some big hotels and other kind of enterprises. But I guess they didn't want it to spread too far. And so they kind of made on this that island there that we were just looking at. Don't do that to me. All right, that we had this particular area. They have big hotels there, look like double trees, that kind of stuff. They got other names on them, and a convention center in the middle. And then half the people in that part of Cuba work there as bellboys and stuff like that. And if you're going to have something in the country, you're going to have it there because the government gives the permits, and that's the place where you can stay, okay? You can also see that Cuba is in a very strategic place as far as the rest of this part of the world. They're very close to Belize. They're very close to Mexico. They're very close to the other Caribbean islands, especially those in the front. And this makes it a very strategic thing. It was strategic for the communists when they started during their deal. It's strategic for us as far as our defense. But it's also, we should think, in terms of the kingdom. It's very strategic as far as the kingdom, where it's almost impossible up until a few years ago for us to go in there. You had to go in through some other country in Central America and then back in, and they couldn't stamp your passport, or you couldn't get back into the United States. But it's very easy for people from Cuba to go to these other Central American countries. The school in Honduras that we help support with our mission money, the preacher school in Honduras has several, I think maybe 8 students from Cuba training to be preachers. These are people that were doctors, engineers, veterinarians, other things. These aren't children. These aren't teenagers. These are guys that have families and stuff and have become Christians, and they want to serve the Lord. And so it's possible for them to go there and get their training where it would be impossible for them to come here. That's a pretty good thing. It's good for us, and it's good there. And I met some of those guys when we were in Honduras a couple of years ago. All right, let's go on here. When we got there, we got to Havana, we go there, and we're right in front of our hotel. This hotel was built by Hilton, and it was... He finished it in 1958. In about 6 months, Castro came into Cuba. It came into Havana and changed the name on it. And so Hilton didn't recover anything from this. This happened many, many businesses and companies and stuff that were there. Another reason why there's been kind of hard feelings there. You see that old car in front? It's like there was a time warp when you go into that country. Everything stopped in 1958 as far as stuff coming from the United States. There's a few other kinds, some Russian stuff and things like that. But everywhere you look, there's an old car like from where you were a kid. And they've kept them running. I don't know how. It's kind of amazing. They also have these kind of these little taxis. I never did get in it. I didn't think if I got in it, I'd ever get out of it. So here's they changed the name from the Hilton to the, means the Hotel of Liberty for Cuba. You could tell it used to be a really, really nice hotel. And they still charge like it's a real nice hotel. But when Castro came in there, and these pictures are everywhere all over the country, everything changed. I want to talk a little bit more about what happened before all of this took place. After he came in 1959, and then in 61 he declared they were socialist. In 65 he declared he was communist and joined the communist bloc, and much aid and support came to him from the Eastern Europeans, came from there, and that's really what kept it going because trade was pretty well over with for them. In 1959, the last census that was taken, all the Americans, of course, left, and most of the other people, except for these two old men that we talked about to start with, they stayed until they were too sick to stay anymore, came home in the 60s. But in 1959, there were 5,000 members of the Churches of Christ. There were 100 meeting places. You could find a church building in 100 different places. These buildings were not all churches. They were like most mission places. They were other kinds of buildings that were being used on Sunday as a church, maybe a store or something else like that. There were actually 6 church buildings that we would recognize as a church building, and they were owned by the church in Cuba. In 1965, they got really difficult. It got difficult to be a Christian in the country there. No literature was allowed to come into the country without approval, and they attempted every way they could, like we did in Eastern Europe with getting Bibles and other things there. In earlier days, the people that print Christian literature, like the guys in Wichita Falls that we support, would send boxes and cases and sometimes even cargo cases full of Christian literature to be distributed. Before this crackdown, that was all permitted and was even encouraged. The first 2 shipments that came afterwards were, they just never saw them. Finally, one day, a big crate, sea crate, was delivered to the church in Havana. And when they opened it up, there was one tract laying in the floor of the building and a letter that says, "You know better than this. Stop it." And when they told you that, people disappeared in those days, and so it was difficult. They began to find churches, as they said, because of discrepancies in their accounting and things of that sort, mostly to seize the financial help that they had. The 100 of those congregations that were meeting in people's homes or other buildings, they lost the place to where they could worship. And so there were 100 congregations that automatically became illegal. Only the 6 that had buildings were recognized as legitimate churches of Christ. Many people during those days fled. Some fled to Spain. It was possible to go there. And they went, as many people came to Florida and to the United States. You know about that. Some people joined denominations because it was illegal to meet where they were. It was a difficult time for the church, and it was a kind of a time of, they won't talk about how severe the persecution was, but it was a time where it was hard for them to do what they did. Christians, there was relief aid given to all citizens because the economy was so shot, maybe food parcels and things like that from the government. Almost no Christians got those because they were on lists of people that really couldn't be trusted. But something happened during those days in the late 60s and early 70s. What happened is the church became so close to each other. They operated in a true form. It would remind you of during the days of the persecution in the first days of the church. The people that had official places where they could go, like the church, the two congregations in Havana, worked up directories of all the people that were still worshiping and still trying to. They made deliberate trips all over that little island because it took days sometime to go from one end of it to the other because of the road conditions and things of that sort. And they traveled by train or by bus or by walking or whatever way they could go. And they encouraged one another. And they worked up opportunities and figured out ways to get some of those people there. And even though the church shrunk in number, they grew very strong in the Lord. For example, there was no grape juice for a period of several years in the country. You just couldn't get it. Unless you had a grapevine, you had no grape juice. But the government had a deal that every year on New Year's Eve, they gave a New Year package to all the families, and there was a bottle of wine in there. And so there was a little ceremony they had on the first of every year where they would bring those bottles of wine up there, and they would make sure that they had enough for the church to have the Lord's Supper. The people memorized hymns because books were seized and Bibles were seized. They memorized scriptures. And also there were times of blackouts because the power grid was not secure and because the country was in financial freefall. And because of that, they were able to worship even if they couldn't see each other's faces. And they worshiped together. Today, there are almost 300 preachers who are registered and told everybody that wants to know that their job is to preach the gospel. They're native preachers. There's no missionaries there. There's people like me that could go and come, but nobody else. And they're meeting in at least 325 locations. Most of them are in people's houses. The government has eased up on many of the restrictions they had for them. And nobody knows exactly how many there are, but there's 6,000 or 7,000 Christians on that little island. And what I saw was that it was absolutely amazing what I saw. Let's look at some of the pictures of some of the things that we saw. This is from the room in the hotel looking at Havana. Havana's a big, really big, millions of people city, you know. We're at church on Sunday morning. This is one of the few congregations that actually have buildings. This is easing up a little bit right now. And we're all getting together. Everybody's visiting before services start. You can see it has all the luxuries. It's totally air-conditioned here, you know. And we know it's a Church of Christ because there's a clock at the back to make sure that the preaching doesn't go. This building, we would say, would seat 100 people. There's usually 200 or more people crammed in there and in this little makeshift park. This man is, his name is Tony. The government requires the churches to be registered, and they require someone to be in charge of all of that. And those old preachers that we talked about before, those two old guys, when they died, they handed the job off to someone else who handed it off to Tony. If you went there as a preacher, like I did, he has to sign the visa because he's the guy that promises the government you're not going to cause any trouble while you're there. That's what his deal is. Now, this is it's not the best situation, but it has advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that those 300 or 250 or so preachers, all of those preachers, They are completely united, like it would be like when you were a kid in maybe the 50s. Everybody preaches the same thing. They all sing the same songs. They all, because no heretics, no left wing or right wing or anybody that's kind of on the edge is going to get past old Tony. The bad thing about it is that you have a guy who's in charge of all of that. And so fortunately for now, that we have a really good man. I can see where this could be a real problem. We should pray constantly about this, that this will have work out. He was welcoming us, and he was at everything that we were involved in. This, of course, you know, that's Jeff Jenkins. He was on the program. This man here has a radio program and an internet program out of Florida. He not only has radio programs he was a missionary somewhere else in South America before. He doesn't look it, but he's 60-something years old and still going strong. But his internet work and his other work, he preaches. They started a new program on a new internet channel, and he has, prepare yourself, 500 people visit his site, 500,000 people visit his site every week. Every week. And they're not just from there, from everywhere they speak Spanish. His radio programs are doing the same thing. He's like a rock star. Everywhere we went, everybody knew who he was because of his effort. He's translating for Jeff. This is some of the guys that were here. This man in the middle right here is, his name is Gary Bradley. He preaches for a large congregation in Alabama. He's been their preacher longer than I've been your preacher. And they've been involved in the work in Cuba for almost 20 years when they were smuggling things and stuff like that. And they were the ones that paid the $40,000 for the lectureship to be able to take place, you know. And so really a great guy. And as soon as we can get his schedule to work with ours, we want him to come and preach to us. He's also a great preacher and a great church builder. One of the things that you're going to notice is all of these, well, that's a government building, but all of these old cars, isn't that something? That one right there is a 58 Plymouth. I had a 57 Plymouth. I haven't seen one in 40 years, but there it is. I don't know what that is, but they're everywhere. If you came to an intersection and there's eight cars there, seven of them are cars like this. See if you recognize something. Are we just going back and forth? All right, here we go. Cars from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and then it just stops. It's against the law to buy one of those cars and take it out of Cuba. They consider them historic treasures. I stood out there 15 minutes, and this is the pictures that I saw. This is a school. We're on a bus now going to the lectureship. There's cannons everywhere. These don't fire. This is historic stuff. You can see that at one time this was one beautiful place, okay? And along the path where the buses go and where the tourists go, and there's cruise ships that stop there, it's fixed up pretty nice. If you get a block away, it starts, see how that looks pretty good? A block away from that, this is what it looks like. And there's blocks and blocks and blocks in Havana of big buildings like this that are empty. Maybe in some of them that had been apartment buildings, there's people living on the fourth, fifth, and sixth floor, but not on a seventh, eighth, ninth, or the first, second, and third. The reason is the first and second floor, the sewer's all backed up in there, and upstairs in the top, the roof leaks, and the top floor is ruined, and then the next floor is ruined, and they're just sort of like one of those after the big war kind of things. People are just sort of of camping there. Some of them, they're kind of fixing up. This is on a main boulevard. Most of them are empty. Why? That would be a Russian apartment type house. Have you ever been in one of those? It's not a very accommodating place to live. Light bulb hanging in the ceiling, that kind of stuff. That night we went to another congregation in Havana. And this was, I'm telling you about this one because this congregation has over 200 people. They meet in outside. That's where they meet most of the time. They have a little building, but there's no room for them all. And this particular place, they've just able to purchase it. They've never been, for 40 years, we haven't been able to buy any property. And there was a doctor who was retiring. He'd been in business before the communists took over. And his estate was, it's 2 or 3 acres, big, great big three-story stone house, a mansion at one time. It had fallen into ruin. And he wanted $60,000 or $65,000 for it. They went to the government guy and asked him if they could buy it. He said, oh, you know you can't buy it. There's no way you can buy this property. And so they talked and talked and talked, and the doctor, I don't know if he had bribed them or something, but he said, is there anything we could do? And the government guy said, if you like these people enough, you can give it to them. And then he turned to them and he said, and if you like that wonderful gift that he just gave you, you can give him $65,000 if you want to. And so sitting in the presence of this communist, they made the trade. But the best thing that happens, it does show maybe an opening that started during our last presidential deal. Maybe the best thing he did during his career was he started opening up these relations with this country, and maybe some good things. That night we had a brother whose name is Nobi. I can't remember his last name, but he is a scientist from NASA. He was on the crew that built the Hubble telescope, and he gave a long speech on the creation. It was amazing. He's also promised as soon as he can get time to come and share this with us. There were lots of people there. That yard was full of people. When you go in a store there, it's kind of interesting. The shelves are all full, but they're all full of the same thing. This was probably 10 foot of shelf, 4 or 5 shelves high, and it's all full of shaving cream, the same brand. And on the next shelf, there was a shampoo, same kind of thing. They haven't really got a handle on marketing yet, but their store was full. We're on our way to the lectureship, and this is I was surprised at how mountainous this country is and how many things are there. This is kind of a roadside place for tourists to stop at, and we stopped there. Lots of pretty stuff. On the bookshelf there was a book by Obama. I didn't buy it, but I thought it was probably. All right, now we're at the hotel where we're staying, and the convention center is next door to it. There's another hotel on the other side, and you can see it's a nice hotel. It's sort of like a nice hotel that is kind of not what it was. You know, but it's still a nice place. In the convention center, we had rooms where everybody could meet together and where we could break up into small groups. All of these, all but probably 30 or 40 people here are preachers from Cuba, and the 30 or 40 are those people who, like me, that had come there to help with this lectureship. There was also some people there from the government writing down every word that everybody said. Every assembly of any kind, there's somebody there taking notes on what's going on. This guy right here is Juan Monroy. You remember him? Juan Monroy was baptized in, I think, 1950 by a Cuban missionary that had gone to Spain and converted him. He was a communist, and he was an editor of a newspaper in Spain. And at the World's Fair in New York back in the 60s, we discovered him. We didn't know that he even existed. And this man had several congregations he had started in Spain. A whole restoration movement was going on in Spain we didn't know anything about. And he was when I was a young man, this guy was it. I didn't know he was still alive. I said, are you Juan Monroy? He said, yes. And I said, how old are you? Because he was a grown man when I was a kid. And he said, I've still got a lot of years in me. He wouldn't tell me, but he preached at least 2 hours every day to some group. And when he wasn't preaching, no one could find him because he'd got a taxi and gone to some church, and he is still blowing and going. And he has been very active in the work in Cuba, even back when we couldn't go in there. People from Spain could. And since he interviewed Fidel Castro back when Castro was hiding in the jungle, Fidel gave him personal permission to come into the country. And so God has used a lot of people to do lots of things. This young man, some of these fellows don't look like they ought to be from Cuba. It's because the Russians lived there for years. And there's a lot of people who are parents, maybe were soldiers or something of that sort. And so this young man is a gospel preacher there. This is one of the classes. This man, he built a church building with his hands in a little village. He's one of those itinerant preachers. He's a farmer. And on his farm, he built this church building. He dug the foundation. He carried the rocks. He mixed the cement. After he had gotten partway through, people started coming and asking him, what are you doing? There wasn't even a church there. He had just become a Christian. He said, this is where the church will meet. The government came and talked to him, said, you have to have permits. He said, do whatever you need to do, but I need to do this because the church is going to meet here. They thought he was eccentric, and they let him go. It's the best building in that precinct. He built it all by hand, and in the hurricanes, people come from miles around to get in there with this guy. And he preaches all the time, and he works with his hands. And when you shake hands with him, you know he's been doing some work recently because his hands are pretty barked up. I was very honored to meet him. That's the kind of people. This is my translator. This guy's got two master's degrees. He was a teacher and everything else, and he is also a preacher. And, of course, he speaks English a lot better than I speak Spanish. This is the convention center where we had our meetings. It's a pretty place. Afterwards, they got everybody together, and they gave us little presents and thanked us for various things that we did. Now we're going back. I think we're done. Let me tell you a couple more things before we finish here. In the last few years, there has been an easing. We don't know how long that will last. They're still communists. They still want to run everything. But they have noticed a couple of things about the church. In those areas, in the rural areas where the church, they're mostly farmers, these Christians have dedicated whole fields that all they do is raise food, and they give it away, and they haul it into town and give it away. In Cuba, a lot of the people that are young have left, are leaving, and so you have more of larger and larger population of old people who can't work. The average wage, I'm sure there are people that make a lot more, but the average person makes about $35 a month. That means that you work, your wife work, your kids work, because stuff costs the same as it costs anywhere else. That also means that you have maybe two jobs. It also means that you might have some sort of little business on the side that you're operating. And when you get old and you can't do that, it gets hard to have enough to eat. And so weekly, there's these trucks that these Christians have commandeered or something full of produce, and it's given away. When the government came to investigate them, they said, what are you doing with this food? It hasn't gone through proper channels. He said, we give it away. And he said, you give it all away? And he says, we don't even eat anything that comes out of this field ourselves. This is totally for the old and the poor. And, of course, that makes the welfare guy look good because his people in his region are eating, and it also makes them look at the church. They asked for 6 years every time they met with the government if they could distribute Bibles. Year before last, they told them, yes, you can distribute, get ready, 250,000 Bibles. If you can pay for them, you can distribute them. Of course, they made some calls to the states, and they got paid for, and they handed them all out. Some denominational people were all upset about it, and they said, how come they got to do that and we didn't? And the big communist guy said, you sell Bibles. These people give them away. Why don't you give them away? And they also were pretty shrewd. They made sure that the local communist guy was at everything every time they handed them out, and they thanked him in front of all these people. And all the people in the town would applaud him. I'm sure it's the only time he ever gets applause. He told them the last time they met with him, we need to do that Bible thing again. And why don't we do 1 million this time? I think there's 11 million people in the country. And they said, what if we get one for every family in Cuba? And he said, that would be great. So who knows what things are happening that are going to be good. It's a very exciting thing that's happening. Also, this church in Alabama they've worked up a deal with somebody that's a member of the church there that builds these metal buildings that you like you put a store in or something. And he's built some kits that they ship in a box. And when you assemble it, it'll seat 100 people or 200 people deciding. They're like $8,000 to $10,000. And the idea is the local church where they get there would pay for the concrete and the wiring and actually put it up. Maybe some people would go down with the kit and help them assemble it. They've been able to put two of these up because this is kind of going against the rule. One of them is in one of the churches that does the food distribution. And the government guys told them, you might need a place to store your equipment and that sort of thing. So they're going, and if you want to worship in there, that'll be all right. The other one is the church that was the spearhead on the Bible distribution. And they said, you might need a place to put all those Bibles before. And if you want to, you see what's happening. They're easing this up. And it could be that maybe someday in our budget for missions, we might every year build a church building in Cuba. If they hadn't had those six buildings, I don't know what would have happened to them. Because that was their hub, their core that they worked out of to accomplish all of this. Lots of things happen. When we first started the mission work down there, the Spanish-American War happened. When we go at it again, we had the Depression. And we also had the Iron Curtain business and all of that. But there's another kingdom going on that we don't ever think about and we should think about. And that sometimes, even in the midst of this horrible stuff, no one will ever record how horrible some of these things are and how difficult it was for some Christians, something pretty amazing happened. When Peter talks about it, he says it's like gold when it's put in that smelter, we redound to the glory of God. And this church that went through a great reduction in members and a great difficulties put on them, their property was taken from them, their automobiles they had were taken, they were not able to meet publicly, they were not able to advertise, they were not able to preach on the radio, they were not able to hand out literature, and yet something else happened. They grew in the Lord and they grew in fellowship with one another, and they still baptized a lot of people. And the group that's there now is amazing. I wondered while I was there, what am I doing telling them anything? Because they are kind of simple as far as their, you know, it's a primitive type situation, but the simple stuff is the main stuff, isn't it? I mean, you know, the foundation stuff is the stuff that holds us together, and they know that, and they know it well. I believe that if this ever opens up, that country is going to really blossom because those people really know how to work and they really know how to live on little. And how would you keep a 57 Chevrolet running for 60 years and not be able to buy a single part? How would you do that? With a file and a vice somewhere, you know? How would you do that? They did it. And so we know they're very creative and everything. And we have a whole group of them that really know the gospel. Of course, when that happens, pornography will come there and all kinds of other junk will happen. And the Copacabana will open up again. We saw where it was. And the Tropicana will open up. And all of the stuff that enslaves people will be there. But there will also be this band of people that know God and know His kingdom. I thought while I was there that this was a very beneficial thing for me to see what's really important. What is important? Obey the Lord, isn't it? And that is, know His Word. Maybe this building isn't that important. It worked really well for them to have it, but what do you really need to have a church? A hole in the ground with some water in it, a Bible, some bread, some grape juice, and some people, right? They've taught us. They can teach us something from that. What do we need to do what we have? Aren't you tired of giving excuses of why you don't do what God wants you to do? And there's always something else. If I just had that or just did this, that I could do it. It's not necessary. And we can learn it from our brothers in a place. It's only 90 miles from the Keys, but it's like you went back to 1930. And it's like when you talk to those people, It's like when I was a boy and every preacher I knew loved God more than he loved his wife or his life. And every church wanted God to be proud of them. And there was a fellowship that they had between them. I know there's lots of stuff we can't do. So far as depends on you, you live at peace with everybody. But it's something. And we could do something about some of that, couldn't we? We could qualify ourselves better, couldn't we? We could be more holy, couldn't we? We could be the kind of person, and that's what's really saved these guys' life, that even their enemy will have to say, this is a good man. He's helping. He's not hurting. He's not after anything we've got. Even the people that don't like God have to say, these people are unusual. I want to thank you for letting me go, but I want to challenge you to listen to the words of our brothers, listen to the life that they've given, and look at the example they have. And let's be better Christians. Could we do that? Sure we could. Will we? You need to come to Jesus. This is the time. Won't you come while we stand and sing?